This is episode 1 of season 4 of The Bad Apples. Hi everyone, my name is Klaatu, and this is, yes, the second episode of the fourth season, and in this episode we're going to talk, we're going to do a Blender update, a Blender video editor update. We're going to talk about Southeast Linux Fest. We're going to talk about other things, so stay tuned. First new order of business, I reckon, would be the new, the updated badapples.info site. That is thebadapples.info. And it is just when I finish 20 episodes, I call it a season, and then I clear off the main page of my site and put all the new shows as they come out on that main page. So if you're looking for back episodes, for instance, from season 2 or 3, I did put the RSS feeds over in the left-hand column of the main page of the index page of thebadapples.info. You can also just manually type in thebadapples.info/index2.html for the season 2 show notes and links to the shows, and in index3.html would be the previous season show notes and all the links to the episode. So that's where everything is, and you'll notice if you ever go to thebadapples.info, you know, like I say, it's all cleared out pretty much. It's just going to start having the new episodes listed. So that's what's going on with that. If by some chance you are a new listener to the show, because I did actually do a little bit of, I guess, promoting of my own show, which is not that typical for me, but I did kind of jump at the chance when someone was doing an email on some other, it was on the Tech Podcast Network, which actually this show is a member of. They were playing some promos, and I sent them a link to my promo. So if you're a new listener from the Tech Podcast Network, you might, if you're new to Linux and this show, you might want to start with season 2. Just go ahead and jump back to season 2 episodes, because that's kind of where I talk a little bit more about, like, beginning kind of Linux-y stuff. So don't hesitate to catch the back catalog of my shows and everything. They're all pretty good. And now, for the rest of the show. Both for myself and for some projects that I've been working on lately. And the default application for this, for graphic work in Linux, is still very much the GNU Image Manipulation Program, which is a program that I love. I did a Hacker Public Radio episode on something called Krita, which is a part of the KOffice suite, and it's a very promising project, and it's neat, and it's great to see other image manipulation programs available, but Krita, it does lack some very important things that you really do need to make it worth using, you know, most notably a proper text tool, especially doing a tutorial where I'm doing typing there on screen, putting little bubbles of instructional text with Krita. That was just not going to work. So I was in GIMP, and one of the things I needed to do was scale some images down, because I've got a lot of screenshots, and I just, they were taken at something like 1280 by 800 or something like that, and I needed to scale them down to, you know, 800 by 600, let's say. And I didn't want to just scale them down in CSS, because I figured it would just take longer to load. So I did want to scale them down in GIMP. So I took a screenshot that I'd done, and I scaled it down, and to my surprise, it looked horrible. And this had never happened before, but I'm not sure how many times I've really scaled either screenshots or anything else down in GIMP with text in it. And this isn't text that you type, this is, you know, text that was on the screen already that has just become a bitmapped image when you do a screenshot. So it's not like the scaling down and scaling down vectors here, it's scaling pixel per pixel by whatever percentage you define in the scale image dialog box. And the text, it looked like I had really, really bad font rendering on my system or something. It was uneven, it was jagged, it looked really bad, and I was very, very surprised by this. obviously something was going on, so I decided, okay, I'll take the original image and try to scale it down in Krita, which I did. The scaling down in Krita, the same amount, same percentage, same exact screenshot source, was perfect. It was beautifully anti-aliased. Well, it wasn't technically anti-aliased, I guess, because it's not true text, but it looked beautiful. It looked like the text had looked at 1280 by 800, only it was smaller. So this was a little bit odd to me. This was something that confused me and fascinated me, and figuring that since it looked terrible in GIMP and good in Krita, it must have something to do with whatever algorithm the two programs are using to do the scaling down. And just for kicks, I tried scaling it down in Image Magic as well, using the Mongrify command. It looked better than GIMP, but not as good as Krita. I didn't sit there and try to get all the options right in Mongrify. I didn't break out the info page and read up on like altering the algorithm or giving preference to this or that, or even setting the quality. I just did a straight 1280 by 800 dot PNG by over to 800 by 600 dot PNG, and it did look better than GIMP, just not as great as Krita. So I went back to the GIMP and looked at the default algorithm that the scale tool was using, which you can find in the preferences of GIMP. And it turns out it's using something called, I think, linear interpolation. And that was obviously not working, so I just played around with different algorithms and eventually figured out that SINC, that is S-I-N-C, with in parentheses, LANCZOS3, L-A-N-C-Z-O-S, and then the number 3. So whatever that is, SINC, LANCZOS3, that's a good algorithm. It's seemed to work pretty well. The weird thing about even that is that when you set the default algorithm in GIMP preferences, and then you go out into GIMP and scale something, it doesn't use the default algorithm. You have to set it yourself in the dialog box, or maybe you have to quit GIMP and reopen it. I don't know. Maybe that's the trick. The point is that the change doesn't take right away, so be aware of that. When you scale it down, it'll come up with another dialog box, and that other dialog box will ask you, or will give you the opportunity to change the algorithm again. Won't make a big deal of it, it's just a selection that if you don't see it on the scale dialog box, you'll miss it. But you do want to change it from the default linear interpolation, that's for sure, because that one just doesn't work. I kind of wonder why linear is the default in GIMP, if it's that bad, but I don't really know that much about resampling images that I would be able to say linear is obviously the wiser choice for maybe, I don't know, raw images, whereas SINC LANCZOS 3 works better for PNG or something. I mean, I just don't know enough about it, so I'm not going to theorize on why the default algorithm is so bad, and one of the extra options is so much better, because it could be that it was just better for this particular task. But that is something to be aware of. If you're doing graphic work and, you're just using the defaults, just be aware that there might be other options for algorithms and things like that. You might get better results using different algorithms. Don't drive yourself crazy trying to try each one every time you scale something, I don't think. But certainly be aware that there's a choice there, and that certainly in 2.6, in GIMP 2.6, the default one isn't all that great. That's my GIMP tip for the week. In the previous episode of this very podcast, I mentioned an application called QTractor, which was a music editing application. Well, an audio editing application. And it was something that I'd found in an RSS feed. I think it was on kde-apps.org. They have an RSS feed that kind of sends out all the different new applications, the new things that you can try out. And it's pretty cool. It's kind of a SourceForge-y kind of site. You can go there and check out all the little applications that people are creating, and you can use them and try them out. And believe me, there are some on there that are just unbelievably good. I mean, really unbelievably good. I should probably mention yet another weather plasmoid, because it is by far the best weather plasmoid I've yet seen. It's a fantastic little application. It's beautiful. It looks great. So look up YAWP on kde-look.org. That should bring it up. And again, it's yet another weather plasmoid.
The Southeast Linux Fest is a community event for anyone who wants to learn more about Linux and free and open source software. It is part educational conference and part social gathering. Like Linux itself, it is shared with the attendees of all skill levels to communicate tips and ideas and to benefit all who use Linux and free and open source software. The Linux Fest is a place to learn, to make new friends, to network with new business partners, and most importantly, to have fun. Come join us for the first annual Southeast Linux Fest on June 13, 2009 in Clemson, South Carolina. Register today at southeastlinuxfest.org.
June 13th, there's going to be the first Southeast Linux Fest, Linux in the GNU South. This is a fest that you've probably heard of already, so I'm not going to dwell on its history or anything. Davey Yates, very good, very popular, a lot of Linux links, Linux user podcast covers this quite extensively because it was him and his lug and the area lugs around his lug in South Carolina started this festival because there just wasn't a festival in that region of the country that was really, you know, a good big Linux festival. Everyone had to travel up to Ohio or over to California for it. So it promises to be a very neat event. It's going to be one day. I'm sure that's very smart when starting a festival to keep it to a one-day event rather than trying to tackle 3 days or something. It goes from, the doors literally open at 8:30 a.m. With the morning keynote at 9, and then the regular speakers and the Birds of a Feather sessions and the expo floor opening up at 10 o'clock, and then it goes all the way until around 1700, which is when the evening keynote occurs. Paul Fields from Fedora does the evening keynote, and then at, I guess they'll probably clean up, and then at 1900 there's going to be an after party. Now the day before there's also going to be a pre-fest party. I guess it's unofficial. I don't know when, it's at 8 o'clock, I don't know where though, but be aware of that. Also be aware that if you're going and have not gotten a room, you want to do that pretty soon because there's a Comfort Inn, I guess, really, really close to where the festival is, but in order to get the discounted room, you have to kind of get it while the getting's good. So if you haven't reserved your room yet, reserve that so that you can get the discounted rate. Obviously, you just want to mention to them that you are attending the Southeast Linux Fest, and they'll hook you up, I guess. Me, myself, I'm not carpooling, but I guess ride sharing down there with a guy who's close to me in my area. So we're looking for, you know, we have two more empty seats, so we're kind of looking around for that. So if you're in the Northeast and you want to do a ride share down to self, just email me and we can see where you are in relation to me right now. So that's about it. Really, I mean, it's going to be a really neat event. If you can, you should try to get down there. You know, I mean, a lot of the speakers are people who you may have already seen or heard. You know, if you go to Linux festivals, Joe Zonker Brockmeyer, for instance, he doesn't keep a low profile. You know, you've probably seen him, well, certainly at Ohio Linux Fest, he was the morning keynote speaker there. But other people are people that you don't really hear a lot from at all, like Robbie Workman and Alan Hicks from the Slackware Project. I mean, Robbie Workman was on the a lot of Linux links being interviewed, but other than that, you don't really hear from him that often. So it's kind of neat to kind of get to hear from some of these people who you really don't get to hear from. And then there's another guy, Chad Wallenberg, who will be speaking, and he's apparently got a podcast out there somewhere. Of course, I'm using understatements for purpose of humor. It's Chad Wallenberg from Linux Basement and Linux Cranks. Of course, everyone knows Chad. His talk should be really good. I'm going to try to attend that for sure because he's a great speaker from what I can tell. And it's always interesting to hear about his typical topic, which is like open source in education. But I mean, it's kind of a cool goal that he's got, you know, trying to get that more integrated into the educational sector. So that would be neat. So yeah, overall, it should be really fun, really cool. So try to make it if you can. Okay, this is a public service announcement of sorts. It's, you know, I have to rant about this once every season. The internets are failing us miserably. And I say this because of little things like companies coding their websites so that they're not compatible with any browser that you throw at it. This is something that you'd think was over and done with. You wouldn't expect to really see it in this day and age, but you still do. The thing that that got me thinking about this again is actually Randy Knows, who's a guy who listens to lots of podcasts, and he's in IRC, and he actually runs the Juiced Penguin podcast himself, which is an OGG-only music podcast, which you should definitely check out. It's just got lots of great music on there, and it's already in OGG format, so you don't have to transcode it for your player or whatever. Anyway, he was setting something up somewhere. I think it was on GoDaddy, and he sent me a screenshot, and I'll see if that screenshot's still online, and if it is, I'll definitely link to it in the show notes. I shouldn't say definitely. I'll try to remember to link to it in the show notes. But anyway, he went to this, you know, site builder page or whatever, and sure enough, he gets an error about him requiring Firefox, I don't know, 2.0 or greater, and he's got on the same screenshot and about Firefox window, you know, from the Firefox, which menu is it? Help. It says help about Mozilla Firefox, right? And it shows you what version you've got, and he's got, sure enough, you know, version 3 or something like that. I mean, it's clearly he's meeting the requirements that they say that they need for their stupid site to work. The clincher, of course, is that it's Linux. So this is really stupid, and I've complained about this before, specifically on a company's online community thing, that they've got storage and everything like that, and, you know, you go there on, in my case, it was on my work Macintosh OS computer, everything works as expected, you go there on a Linux computer, and nothing works. Same deal, it says you need such and such a browser, you look at your browser, you meet or exceed the requirements. It's just not working because it's on Linux, and they've coded it incorrectly. So the idea of the internet is to provide information, and I guess nowadays it's also to provide a service. And there's a really, really interesting talk on the, I think it's Planet Libre, which is some kind of festival the FSF held, I think. And MonsterV is currently reposting all the audio from that conference as Hacker Public Radio shows, but there is one in there, and I don't remember who it was who spoke about this, but he was talking about how services these days are kind of, online services are kind of posing an interesting quandary for the whole idea of free software, because what's the idea of freedom when it's just a service? I mean, do you still want the source code of their program? Well, okay, big deal, they give you the source code. If you're using their online service, it's not really the source code that you need. It's more like control over your data, and that's what a lot of these things take away from you. So whether or not it's a good thing that the internet is going towards this sort of cloud computing and service-based model is definitely subject to a lot of debate. So far, I've had zero luck with the whole cloud computing thing. You know, I mean, it works for simple things, but the minute it comes down to some kind of mission-critical thing, you try to log on, and for some reason, you can't log on. It's a showstopper. It really is. So I'm not a big fan of it, but I am a big fan of the internet as a means of delivering information. It's the information superhighway, remember? And if you're coding your website so that they're only compatible with such and such a browser, or such and such a browser running under such and such an OS, you are defeating the purpose of the internet. You are automatically, right away, the internet is broken because of how you are delivering the information you are trying to deliver. Furthermore, if you're not keeping in mind that some people surfing the webs do not have the capability of sight, you are further failing, because the information that you want to deliver is automatically and immediately excluding a large portion of your audience, or at least a significant portion of your audience. These people need text-based websites, and frankly speaking, even people with sight need text-based websites. I certainly wouldn't mind, and do not mind, seeing a website having either a text alternative or just being coded in such a way that it looks good in a text browser. And this is because I, like many other Linux geeks, don't always start X. You know, it's not a given that I'm running a graphic environment. If I'm just taking notes for a podcast, or if I'm just maybe shooting some emails off, or just doing a little bit of web surfing or whatever, chances are I'm not in a graphical environment. I'm probably just in a little console, a text console, using Alpine and maybe E-Links for the web surfing bit, or more often than not, it's just Alpine and Vim. And what do you need graphic environment for that? You don't really need that at all. So if I'm doing something and I suddenly decide, okay, here I've got Alpine, I've got Vim, don't have the graphics up, but I need to check something online, you can imagine how annoying it is to go to a site that you know has the information you need, or maybe you go to Google and you look and you find a site that sounds like it's going to be good. You go there, and it's not friendly with e-links. It's annoying. So if you are coding a website, keep these tenets in mind. And if you come across a site that does break the internet in this way, I would let them know. I would have said it was probably useless and pointless to even bother. But frankly, I mean, it actually does help. If for no other reason, then at least we can say that we tried, you know? If in the near future it becomes all Flash-based and all this other stuff, and none of us can use e-links ever again, at least we can sit down over coffee and say honestly that we tried to preserve the integrity of the internet. And then we'll proceed to reinvent our own internet. But I think 2 weeks ago, no, it was more like 2 months ago now, I was in Maryland doing some stuff, and I was over at a friend's house, and I commented on this in a previous episode, just how I turned a PC into a Linux laptop, and no one noticed. But the friend was looking for their state representative for some reason. So I went on to Google, you know, and looked up the Maryland state Congress representative or whatever, and I went to their page, and to my great surprise, there was a notice on this page that was listing, and I unfortunately didn't think of any of this at the time, so I didn't bother like taking screenshots or anything like that. But on this page, on this random little tiny, you know, no one's ever going to go to this page, but it's a page of just your state representatives in Maryland. So it's like a Maryland government page, and it's got, it lists the people you need to write to complain about something or whatever. So I went here, and I looked, and right on the page it says, this site best viewed with Internet Explorer, like, I don't know, 6 or 7 or something. And I was shocked. And because I was in Maryland, basically on vacation, and I had nothing but time, I figured, why not? I'll just shoot an email off to these people. That way I can log the complaint. So I emailed the webmaster, and usually, you know, if you just do webmaster@domainname.com, that'll get to that person, you know. And I think they actually had a webmaster contact on that page. You could also do like a who is on that site, and figure out who the technical contact is for that site. So I mean, there are many easy ways to find out who to email. So just shoot an email off to them. I just said, hey, look, recommending Internet Explorer on a government site is, number one, wrong, because you are giving support to a company that really shouldn't have any kind of market advantage over, you know, any other company. So what are you doing recommending that people get their product on a public government site? And then number two, it's just plain stupid, because recommending Internet Explorer excludes any Mac user and any Linux user, since both of those platforms do not have a version of Internet Explorer that will work on them. But I really didn't ever expect to hear back from this site. And much to my surprise, like a couple of weeks later, I actually got a response. And the webmaster was really nice and really polite. And she said that actually it was just a notice that she'd accidentally left on from, like, you know, probably the early 90s or something. I mean, it was a long time. You know, she's had it, the site, probably she made it on Front Page or something, and she just kind of left the notice up there, and she said she would remove it. And that kind of surprised me, and I checked back on the page, and sure enough, she'd removed the notice. So, little simple things like that, and you know that this is, like, not a big deal. It's a random, tiny little government site on who knows where, and no one's ever going to go there except, like, you know, the 5 people who need to look up their state representative who happen to look at that site rather than probably a dozen other sites that'll come up on Google. But the point is, I wouldn't have even expected that much to work, and it did work. So logging a complaint is just kind of like, it's doing the bare minimum. That way we're saying, hey, look, this is stupid, don't do this anymore. And it might make a change. It might actually get people to change something about their site, or to add the HTML information in plain text where otherwise they didn't have an option to view the site in just plain HTML. Things like that. So keep that in mind, and let's make the internet not bad. And now for a quick note on how the internets are succeeding. Pat from the Linux Link Tech Show has started a new podcast called the Myth TV Cast, which you can find at mythtvcast.com. And what's really neat about this is that the show is in AUG only, and I think of that as a big, big win. As you may or may not know, I was inspired to go AUG only one day, and I've received no negative feedback on that whatsoever. So that was kind of a neat thing to do. I was kind of, you know, after I got such good comments, I was really glad that I did it. I was nervous doing it at first, but then I was happy. Then the Linux Cranks decided to go AUG only. They got a lot of negative feedback about it. We got rude comments. We were called names. People commented on us doing it, saying that we were going to lose, quote, 80% of our audience, all this other stuff. I don't know what the big deal was. I thought it was really cool. A lot of people had problems with it, and probably still have problems with it, but I still think it's really great, and you know why if you've listened to my show. Well, Pat and his co-host, Dan, not Dan from Tilts, another Dan, they decided to go AUG only, and for whatever reason, I think Pat in IRC claims that it was because of laziness. You know, he doesn't want to have to export the show two times, one for AUG and one for MP3, and admittedly, that's a big deciding factor. Like, I know it doesn't sound like a big deal to have to export a show twice every time you do a show, but it actually kind of is, because especially someone like Pat, who podcasts every week, and now he's doing Myth TV Cast every other week, I think. So it becomes a real bother to have to constantly export everything two times, and then upload them two times, and then update your RSS feed two times. You know, I mean, it starts to pile up after a while. So that's a big deciding factor, I guess, just sheer laziness. And his other reason was that Myth TV is a little bit of a niche audience, so he figures he's probably pretty safe going AUG for the Myth TV Cast. I think it's fantastic, because this is the third AUG-only show that I know of now, and it's really, really taking a stand and saying, look, AUG is good enough for the internet, it's good enough for your media player, it's our codec, we own it, we will use it. Fantastic. So go Pat, go Dan, and check out Myth TV Cast, because it's actually really, really informative. MythTVcast.com. I mean, Pat, as you probably know, knows a lot about Myth TV. He's talked about it before. They did the Myth TV month on Tilts. I mean, he's savvy about that stuff. This guy Dan, I don't know where he comes from or who he is, but he clearly knows what he's talking about. It sounds like his setup is quite nice. So these are really informative episodes. Whether or not you're going to build Myth TV, it's just kind of cool to hear about, at least for me, because a lot of the stuff they're talking about is stuff that I have a really strong interest in anyway, like video transcoding or which video card is really best for your Linux box, things like that. So check this out for sure. It's mythtvcast.com. It is AUG only. They have two episodes, episode 0 and episode 1, and they, as far as I know, they're going to keep going, so just check it out. It's really good. Yes, it is time for coffee, and keeping in mind the various tenets of the Unix philosophy, let us remember that simplicity is true beauty. So I encourage you to go out the next time you're shopping for coffee and try to find a simple, humble kind of roast of coffee and give that a try. My blender idea was to create a video editor based on Blender source code, just to take what they already had, their little video sequence editor, VSE, and make it better, a lot more robust, and a lot more like what a video editor would need in order to sit down next to someone running Final Cut Pro or Avid and actually get their work done. The problem with this is that you need someone who knows how to program, and I did attempt to find someone who knew how to program, and I had someone recently, if you've been keeping up with this show, as recently as, I don't know, 2 months ago now, I had someone who was supposedly working on the idea, just basically we had only gotten to the very, very beginning stages of how how will this work? You know, how will this, how can this be done? Is this a series of patches, or is it a series of Python scripts, or a mixture of both, or, you know, whatever. He went off to apparently draw up a game plan, you know, kind of come up with how this is all going to be possible, and I never heard from him again. He just kind of disappeared, got absorbed into everyday life, I guess. And that was a little bit odd because I was actually offering to pay this programmer. I posted it as a job listing with pay. So, I mean, you know, and there's still the option of trying to get money together and getting someone on a paid basis to make this project happen. But before bothering with any of that, I figured it would be a good idea to establish a little, let's call it a community portal, and maybe even a project page, and just kind of poke around at it myself. And since deciding upon that, I have established a little communications site at thebadapples.info/blender, and there's just a little blog software that I threw up there. It's probably not the right software for what I'm doing, but oh well. It's called Geeklog, but it's a little forum kind of thing, or really it's a blog, so I'm sure it's really definitely not the right thing, and anyone's welcome to join. So you know, I've got a couple of people who have opened up accounts there already. There hasn't really been any activity on it yet because nothing's really happened with this idea, and I haven't really had time to even look at the source code. I just downloaded the source code recently, so you know, eventually something will happen with all of this, or not, and we'll just I'll just figure out how to pay someone to do it for me. But until that time, I figure it's a really good idea to try to start on whatever level I can start. And like I say, I've gotten Scarlett has signed on. My friend Scarlett from Fedora Reloaded has kind of signed on, so she might be able to do like graphic work or something like that. I mean, I can do that too, but the more the merrier. Monster B's signed on. As far as I know, he doesn't really know anything about this either, but he knows a lot about like Linux and things like that, and certainly his support is appreciated. And then recently a guy named Thoth, T-H-O-T-H, has emailed me a couple of times about this whole idea, and he's found a lot of really cool resources, actually, which is much appreciated. It was quite unexpected as well, but he found a page on the Blender Wiki where they've got a series of feature requests that already exist, that people have already posted for the video sequence editor specifically. And a lot of them are the same exact things that I've been thinking needed to be added to the video sequence editor. So there are people out there who are thinking about the same thing. It's just no one's moving on it yet. But that's fine. If they move on it first, that's fantastic. Otherwise, I'll continue to move as slowly as I am. Quickly as possible, but it's going to be slow going because I don't know how to program on how to implement this idea. But Thoth does know how to program. He's a programmer and a video editor, which is pretty neat. And so he knows about this stuff, and he might be able to really help make some headway on the project idea. What I need to do initially is figure out how it's all going to happen, and we'll see what happens. No guarantees. It's just kind of basically a place that we can go and kick around the source code. It's thebadapples.info/blender, and if you want to go there and sign up, you certainly are welcome to do so. You don't have to quote contribute anything to sign up. You can sign up if you just want updates on it to kind of follow it or track it or whatever, or if you think maybe someday you will have something to contribute. And keep in mind that it's quite possible that nothing will ever come of this. It's quite possible someone else will beat us to the punch and come out with a great Blender revision, and we won't have to worry about it. Just as much as it's possible that you know, me and Thoth and a couple of other people will actually put down some code and make some changes to Blender. We'll see what happens. Either way, if you want to kick around the idea, kind of keep in contact or keep updated about it, just go to thebadapples.info/blender and set up an account there. It's a really simple little blog site. You're welcome to post stories or comment on stories that already exist. And that's kind of where the whole Blender idea is right now. And in the future, I mean, I'll continue to give updates on Blender on the show, but we'll also have that site for updates. So if you're wondering what's going on, if anything, you don't have to wait to see me in IRC. You can just go to thebadapples.info/blender, and any progress, if any progress is being made, I will post there for sure. So that's Blender for you. We'll be right back. feeling that you get, that overwhelming sense of love and satisfaction when you are sitting in front of your Linux box and you're using some application or you're starting up a graphical interface and you just, everything's working and it looks so great and it's performing so well and it makes things so easy and you're just so happy and it's this overwhelming sense of computing satisfaction. Well, I get that feeling a lot lately, and so I've been writing down kind of like why I'm feeling that way in that moment. And there are actually some really good reasons for loving Linux with as much passion as one can feel for a computing environment. There are some good reasons, and it's good, I think, to record some of that, because when people ask me what it's all about, like, why do I like Linux so much? Why am I always going to these meetings and these festivals, and why am I podcasting and listening to podcasts and reading books and all this other stuff, and why do I always mention it? You know, what's the big deal? It's actually kind of hard to, at least for me, it's difficult to come up with a good reason when someone asks, because it's just kind of like, well, I don't know, I just really like it. You know, I mean, I don't really know why exactly I like it, I just do. That's kind of not an answer, you know, that's kind of like, that's a cop-out. So I figured I should start recording some of the hard and fast reasons that I do like Linux and that I find it so appealing and why I get excited about it. And so here's what I've got so far. Number one is smart applications. And when I say smart applications, it's because there are certain things like GNU/Vue and KDE. If you've ever used that, it will blow you away. And it used to just be like most image viewers, you know, you kind of, the coolness of it is lost on you at first because you're like, yeah, just open up and let me see my image. Or maybe you don't even want to use an image viewer. You just want to use Conqueror and have the image open up there in Conqueror. And then you can go back and, you know, you never have to leave Conqueror. Both ways are fine, but GNU/Vue has really started to impress me, because what will happen is if you open it up without opening an image, you know, if you click on an image and it opens GNU/Vue by default as your image viewer, that's fine, and that'll be pretty transparent to the user. I mean, there's an application, I'm looking at my images. Now, one nice thing is that it will automatically find other images in that same directory, so that if you want to continue looking through images, you don't have to close it and then open it back up. And I know that this is not a big deal for people who are used to, I think, maybe Internet Explorer or whatever they use, you know, for that desktop thing. Or not Internet, like Microsoft Explorer or whatever. Desktop Explorer, I don't know what it's called. But that thing, I think it does the same thing. But I know that macOS, when you click on an image, you get to see only that image. And it doesn't think to look further in that directory and give you the option to continue looking through images. Pretty bad. So GNU/Vue does that. It's very nice. The cooler thing about it, though, is that when you open up GNU/Vue without opening up an image, it shows you, it becomes a little mini file manager, and rather than just being a blank screen. You know, it actually shows you your directories in your home folder, gives you the places recently viewed, things like that. So, I mean, right there, I mean, the functionality of that application has doubled or tripled, because, okay, you've opened it without finding which image you want to look at. It doesn't mean you just want to open the application and sit there and look at a blank screen. You know, it allows you to go that next step and find something to look at. Very, very nice touch. And that kind of thing, I mean, just that kind of small, really well-designed functionality, and you know that it was just some programmer who opened up GNU/Vue one day, and it was blank, and they said, you know, it would be really nice if I could get through my file system right here from GNU/Vue. And so they added it, you know. I mean, it was just, that's how this whole process works. And that's why it's so powerful, this whole environment, because it's all free and you can just do things like that. So that's really nice. It's really cool. And speaking of that kind of efficiency is a big thing about Linux that I really do like. I mean, really simple things, like if I want to open a document, let's say. So if I do a vim space /documents/ whyilovelinux.txt. Well, right there, I've opened vim, I've established a new document, I've named the new document, I've placed that document in a directory in my file system, all at the same time. And that's four steps right there that I've done all in one command. Like, very literally, it's one command. It's not even one command piped to another command. It's one command. Seems simple to you and me, because it's probably what we do all the time, right? But compare that to some GUI text editor where you have to open it up, you actually open the text editor itself up, and then you start to type. And then at some point during your typing, you realize, wow, I really need to save this. And so you go to save it, and then you navigate through the save dialog box so that you can find where exactly you want to save it, and then you find that directory, and then you name the document, and then you click, and then you probably have to fight with it to try to keep the format that you actually want to use. You know, you just want it to be a .txt, and it'll offer, well, what you really want this to be saved as is a .doc or a .xml or a .rtf, you know, and you're just like, no, really, I just want it to be .txt. So, efficiency, big appeal of Linux for me. And then, of course, there's configurability. And this is a big thing for everyone. It's one of the reasons I think that a lot of people come to Linux in the first place, is because they keep hearing about how they can configure their computer to be and do exactly what they want. And it's very true. You can do, you can set up your environment however you want it, as you and I well know. And I'm not going to go into how cool all the different desktop environments are and blah, blah, blah. It's really, for me, it's a little bit more, it's simpler than that. There are applications that you can install and just live inside of and just get all your work done. It's just, and that application can be one click away, or it can be one KRunner typing in away, or a GNOME do, whatever you use, or it can be an icon away. I mean, you can do things any way you want them to be done. And yeah, some of that can be done in Windows and Mac as well, I'm sure. I mean, there are options for different ways of doing things in those environments. But one of the other things that you can do in Linux that you really can't do in any of these other environments is really, really configure your visual environment, you know, the graphic environment. And I mean, just with something like KDE, I mean, I've got a couple of different users on a couple of different computers. For each of those users, I can have a completely different looking, even just KDE. I mean, you can have stock KDE, or you can have a panel on the bottom auto-hiding with all your most used applications, kind of like a dock. You can have a panel up at the top, or a panel up at the bottom, or both, or neither. You know, you can just, I mean, there's just so much you can do just within one desktop environment, not to mention all the different desktop environments that you have to choose from in the first place. And then that is not to mention, again, doing something like, I think, The Last Known God, if I'm remembering correctly, it's him. You know, he's got, like, OpenBox with, like, a GNOME panel or something like that. And Captain Pedro had, like, I think it was OpenBox with an XFCE panel or something like that. You know, I mean, you can just mix and match. You can do whatever you want. So it's really cool. And you probably already know that. And then there is, again, just X in general. Like, Zorg X. Having direct control over what you see on your screen via a text-based terminal is—it's not just cool, but it's just immensely powerful and very, very flexible. And that's the kind of thing that I think is really important. That's the sort of thing that you want above and beyond, you know, spinning desktop cubes and spinning desktop cubes while you're video editing and, you know, whatever else people want their Linux box to do. The fact that you can control your graphic environment via a text terminal really is cool, and it's helpful, and it becomes really apparent when you're doing things on a network. And I've had to do enough things over a network. Typically, they're repetitious kind of functions that, in theory, you could write like a shell script to do. This kind of thing is simply not something that you can do on an environment where there's not really an interaction between your scripting environment and your graphical environment. And this is a problem. And for a very, very simple, yet again, as always, real life example of why this is an issue to even think about, go over to a Mac box somewhere, right? And open up 8 tabs, or 9, or 10, or 20 tabs in Firefox. And then force quit Firefox. And I say force quit because I want it not to have the chance to save your tabs. You know, if you quit Firefox, it'll say, okay, you've got like 10 tabs open. Do you want me to save them for next time? And you can say yes or no. Well, if you force quit it, it won't be able to ask you that. So now you've just quit Firefox. Go over to your Linux box and SSH with the -X switch into that Mac box. So I'll do an SSH space -X space Clatu at Macbox and put in the password, and then you can start Firefox itself via the open space -a space firefox.app command. But who cares, because that's as far as you're going to get, okay? Especially if something has had to force quit or was shut down improperly, you're not even going to get Firefox completely open remotely, because it's going to hang at the dialog box asking you if you want to restore the session. And even if you didn't do that, even if you had it opening up all the way, maybe it wasn't closed improperly, someone did a quit and you know, maybe they said, yeah, save the tabs or not, it doesn't matter. Point is that if you're able to open it, open-a firefox.app, your interaction with Firefox ends there. So all you've been able to do from a remote location is start the application. You can't look at it, you can't go into it, you can't check out the bookmarks stored in its inside of it. You're just out of luck. And the reason that you're out of luck is because there's no interface. On the Cocoa side of things on the Mac, there's no talking between your terminal and that application. It's not possible. It's a layer on top of Unix that essentially is inaccessible. Okay, so now let's say that you went over, again, just for sake of keeping everything diverse, go to over to a Mac, start up X11, and start up an X11-based version of Firefox. This you would not find on a typical Mac. You'd have to hack it and figure out how to do all that, which can be done, I mean, it's pretty easily via Mac ports. But anyway, let's assume that you've done all that. So you've got a Firefox-X11 instance. You open that up. And again, let's open up like 8 or 9 tabs and then quit it, killing X11, and it's going to kill the Firefox instance that's open within it. It's not going to ask you, you know, whether you want it to save your tabs or anything like that. So you kill it. And now you go over to your Linux box again, and ssh-x clatu@macbox, put in your password, and start Firefox-X11. The first thing you're going to notice is that, sure enough, you're actually seeing stuff on your screen. Unlike when you're starting a Cocoa app and you don't actually see anything on your local machine, you know, you don't even get the dialog box of do you want me to restore the tabs or whatever. You don't even get to see that, and you can't answer it on your Linux box. But when you're forwarding X, okay, now you can click on OK. You can get Firefox will boot up, start up right there on your screen, etc., etc. And for this reason alone, whenever I am stuck on a Mac at a job, if possible, I will install X11 right away and then proceed in installing all the different applications that I know I'm going to need, either there on the site or off site, because it's just ridiculous not to do it any other way. And that is why I like Linux so much. And there are so many other reasons, you know, the fact that it's a multi-user system where, you know, if I'm out and I know that I need some kind of data on a remote computer, even if that computer's on and being used by someone else, I can log in as myself and do what I need to do. For them, it'll be completely in the background. They have no idea that I'm there. They don't need to know that I'm there. I get the information that I need, and then I log off. And it's just it's a really, really, really great way of computing, and it's kind of the ideal of computing. This is the kind of thing that, this is the reason we have computers. This is the reason we have networks. This is the reason we've got all this stuff, to make our life easier, not to promote a company and their specific product. You know, I just want to get my work done. I don't care about the logo on the back of the computer. I don't care about whether I'm using their specially branded web browser. But, you know, there you go. Linux is very flexible, very powerful, and that's why I love it. Glad I could get that out and share that with everyone. But remember that. So next time someone asks you why you love Linux, these are some reasons that at least I love it, and you probably do too if you think about it. I think that wraps up the show for this week. Thanks for listening. My email, if you need to contact me, is clatu@hackerpublicradio.org. My website, the Bad Apple website, is badapples.info. So check that out for show notes and links and things like that. And thanks for listening, and I'll see you next week.